This is Roger Molina on Creative Disturbance. I'm delighted today to be talking again with Neil Rolnick. We just finished our first podcast, and for those of you that didn't listen to it, I recommend you do. Neil, maybe you could just present yourself again rapidly, and then we're going to talk a little bit about the MFA program at RPI that you helped set up.
Okay. I'm Neil Rolnick. I'm a composer living in New York now, and in the 80s and 90s, I was kind of the key for setting up the IEAR program at Rensselaer. And where we left off last time, we were just talking about the kind of the impetus for thinking about the program. And the real force of it was that at the time, John Sturgeon, Mark Gresh, and I were teaching at Rensselaer. There was no community of people really interested in what we were interested in. We were sort of doing service classes. And it became clear to us that the way to make it an interesting place for us to be was to work at creating a community of people who had the same general interests and were interested in new art and new music and the interface with technology.
But presumably that you also sensed that there was, even though obviously, as you mentioned before, Rensselaer is dominated by engineering sciences and so on, that there was a student population that potentially would be interested?
Yes. No. There was a small group, mostly around the radio station, that was much more experimental and engaged with lots of interesting things. But that was a very small group, and it was not even all students. The way that our thinking went was that particularly when we started, and this is kind of detailed in the article, when we started looking at a curriculum, it became clear that there was not enough support at Rensselaer to think about an undergraduate curriculum in either fine arts or music, and there wasn't the student body, to make something that combined the technology, visual arts, and musical arts was going to be a humongous program. Many years and much more support than we had. So our thought was, well, first of all, when John arrived, particularly, he and I just played with each other a lot. So I would go into his studio and learn how to manage the video editing and the shooting and syncing everything up. And he would come into the music studio and I'd show him how things work there. And so we did some projects together. We're both interested in performance, and we together came up with the idea that what we could do, since we didn't have the support for an undergraduate program, was just to start with a graduate program which would be focused on making art with technology, and integrating both both the visual and musical arts. And it was a gamble.
This was within the art department, right?
Yes. Yeah. Well, it's an arts department with an S.
Yeah. Okay. So it had both music and visual art in the same the departmental structure.
And we were actually very lucky that there was no history there. The department had been started by Larry Kagan, who I mentioned before, in 72. So we just kind of walked into something where there were no rules.
Yep.
And so the idea of sort of attracting students, and in fact, when we the first year, we said we were going to bring in 8 students a year for the graduate program and got approval from the school, and we were going to get $200,000 to equip, to build and equip studios.
Uh-huh.
And we were able to enroll the 8 new students, and the $200,000 never showed up. And and I talked to the provost, who said, well, we never really thought we were going to get art students here, so we didn't put aside the money. And I ended up in May calling the president's office and saying, either we got to get money to build studios, or I got to call the students and tell them that the program's canceled.
Okay, your story sounds very familiar.
And the $200,000 showed up the next day.
Well, it was kind of, yeah, anyway. I guess your feeling is that one of the originalities of the program at the time was this really integrated approach.
Yeah.
Obviously, Karma, Stanford, there were a number of other programs in the country, but they tended to be focused on particular media or particular...
Yep. Exactly. Karma, CalArts, which is another place I visited when I was on my tour, and of course I knew Karma very well because I'd been there.
Yep.
There was also a lot of work being done in Denton in Texas. Larry Austin was there and doing really interesting stuff. There was stuff happening at the Art Institute and the visual side of things, at MIT, the Media Lab. But all of things were really segregated by discipline.
Yeah.
And we, in a way, by necessity, because we had at that point. One video artist, one musician, and one person who did. At that point, Mark was working on most 3D graphics, using polarized screens as a way of making the 3D. Those were our resources.
Yeah. In your article, you identify a few things about the culture and atmosphere.
Yeah,
one of the ones that caught my attention was that dealing with the administrative and technical stuff.
Yep.
And how they were really encouraged and enabled to take the studio classes and a lot of the content that you were developing. So
yep.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that's something I believe in heart and soul. I think that. This kind of came a little bit, as much of what happened at RPI did, came as a reaction to my experience at ERCOM, where it felt like ultimately things were very hierarchical.
Yeah.
There were the great artists, there were the assistants, there was the clerical staff, and while people got along well together, there was this sense of hierarchy that just felt like it was not right, and it was not a really really didn't make community in a way that I wanted to see it made. And I feel like in the article I mentioned models of the Bauhaus, and where I'd had actually. Personal connection with Walter Gropius when I was a student, and also Black Mountain College. And one of the things that struck me about those two models, besides the fact that some really interesting ground, epoch-changing work came out of them, is that they were in the moment and they were not so concerned with persisting and continuing, but rather focused on what was happening now. And basically everyone whom we initially hired to work at IEAR were people who one way or another really wanted to be involved with the arts. So for the most part, they were young people who got jobs as technicians or working in the as administrative staff, a really interesting composer named Seth Kluwit first came to us as an administrative assistant, and then ended up enrolling in the program, going to Princeton and getting a graduate degree, and is now a professor in New Jersey. And you know, so the idea was we wanted to be an attractor, and that meant that everyone working in the place became part of the creative community. So,
yep.
So, and particularly since at that time, the idea of having personal gear that you could work on was unheard of. Everything was in the studio
and shared.
We wanted to have people just floating in and filling the space with new activity all the time.
Okay, let me just get to this this point you made about that. You know, one of your primary goals was not institution building as such, but that you were interested in building this, I guess, this intensity that responding to the shared interests of the faculty, students, and staff at the time.
Yeah.
And indeed, as you know, 2 years ago, CAVS at MIT folded. There's been a succession of places in our community that were created and that have come and gone. And I think, obviously, universities traditionally are interested in longevity and student enrollment and all those other issues. And I think you make a valid point that, you know, on the one hand, obviously, what you were doing meant taking some risks in the kind of program that you were doing. But it was really the intensity of that activity that drove you and not institution building as such. Okay. Now, that's not to say that all institutions should self-destruct.
No.
But sometimes they do outlive their original rationale.
Well, that's why I'm no longer associated with the university. I felt from the very beginning, and I still believe that I enjoyed being part of Rensselaer while I was there, and I enjoyed the ability to work within the institution to build something that I couldn't have done on my own. I needed the institutional imprimatur, and I needed the institutional money to make it happen, and the structure of being able to be a degree offering in a place that would offer degrees and had all of that thing. So I think I don't want to belittle that. But at the same time, the entire project for me was driven by a real sense of kind of artistic mission, and what was important was nurturing a community of people who would go forward and make their own artistic and musical worlds.
Yeah, I mean, just as a side comment, yeah. I mean, I think obviously there's also just the personal cycles that people go through where there are chapters in their life,
yep.
And you kind of close a chapter and open a new one. Obviously, institutions are working on very different timescales than individuals, and sometimes those match and sometimes they don't. And I just wanted to mention that one of the names you mentioned and a colleague of ours, Jean-Claude Risset, is happily living about 50 kilometers from where I'm doing this podcast from. And he has happily left behind every institutional role or function that he ever had, and is back fully in his compositional musical practice. And so
I didn't know that. That's wonderful for Jean-Claude.
Yeah, and I run into it. We try to invite him to meetings occasionally, and he just refuses.
Yeah, well, you should say hi from me.
I will do that. But indeed, there are timescales that human beings go through, and there are timescales that the institutions, and sometimes those synchronize, and sometimes they don't. And
there's something else though, which I think has to do more with artistic temperament, which is that making art requires taking risks.
Yep.
And on all levels, whether it's you know, anything about your life, I think that if you're going to be engaged as an artist, you have to be not too attached to security.
Yeah.
And so the ability to just say, I'm going to do something for as long as it works. When it stops working, time to change.
Okay, so I think we're going to have to wrap this up.
Okay.
But I suspect that the title of this podcast will have to do with balancing the risk-taking of the artist and the conservatism of institutions. We'll find some way of articulating that.
Yeah.
Anyway, Neil, thanks for the two discussions, and I look forward to being in touch in the coming years, and thank you for publishing your memoir in Leonardo.
Well, thank you very much, Roger. I appreciate it. I enjoy it.